Is the globe warming or cooling? Is it man-made? Does that really matter? And if it does matter, how is that being used to plunder you? We'll answer these questions and more next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Executive Director of Camp American, and I'm also the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy. This is part four of a four-part series from Dr. Michael Kaufman, who spoke at Camp American in 2012 about his book called Plundered. And that book basically ties together what look like a lot of loose threads on our worldview, our concept of liberty, how our worldviews can be manipulated, and how the manipulation of those worldviews can be used to plunder us of our liberty, of our property, of our money, of our families. That may sound like a rather paranoid or out there oddball assessment of the situation, but the fact is that Dr. Kaufman does a great job over these four lectures of tying all those threads together. And that's really kind of what matters. Can they be tied together, and can they be done so in a coherent fashion? And that's exactly what Dr. Kaufman does in this particular series. Now, well, let me get this out of the way first. Barry Sheets will be back next week. We decided that we would go ahead and run all four parts of Dr. Kaufman's presentation together rather than piecemealing it and running it all in pieces so that it would be difficult for you to find the other pieces. We decided to run them all together so they're all on the iPod feed together. And by the way, yes, you can subscribe to this podcast by iTunes. We've had some issues with it of late. However, we're trying to get those fixed, but they are available on iTunes. Hopefully, we'll have it all fixed up for you very quickly. In any case, Barry will be back. We'll be talking about some issues. We'll be running some interviews with authors and players in the culture wars. And yes, there is such a thing as culture war. I realize that there are some people who really hate that phraseology. Well, guess what, folks? It is a war. There's always been a war. There's been a war since Genesis 3, and that's back very close to the creation of the world. And yes, I did say creation. And the fact is that that war will continue until Jesus Christ makes his enemies his footstool and throws all Satan and his minions into the lake of fire, where, in fact, he will not rule and reign. He will be a mere servant in the flame. So that's another question for another program at another time. We're going to go back to Dr. Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman this week talks about the whole concept of climate change, global warming, global cooling. What is causing it? Is it man-made? Is it from natural causes? Let me ask you a question that hopefully you'll find out in Dr. Kaufman's presentation. Could you marshal the facts about these things? There's an awful lot of stuff out there in the media about quote-unquote climate change, and we hear about quote-unquote extreme weather. It's more extreme now than it's ever been. If you watch the Weather Channel, you will see that they try to stretch weather events into these horrible extreme examples. Well, I would point to the fact that one of the predictions of global warming theory is that we should be suffering through super hurricanes at this point because of all this global warming. Part of the theory, it's a complex part, but part of the theory basically says that we should be suffering all these horrible hurricanes. This has been one of the quietest hurricane seasons on record. And as I record this on the 3rd of October in 2014, just as a timestamp, we haven't had a serious hurricane the entire season. The season will be over, I think, November 1st. It's either October 31st or November 1st, I think, is when. Now, I could be wrong on that, and you can inform me by email if you'd like. But the fact is that that season will be over, and we haven't had a serious hurricane. In fact, we haven't had a really serious hurricane. We've had a couple of doozies that blew up the East Coast, but that weren't really particularly serious. We haven't had a really serious one for several years. Again, we had a minor hurricane that ran into a winter storm that blew into New Jersey, and everybody thinks that was a super hurricane. It wasn't. It was like a Category 3 that combined with a big snow front, and that turned into what's known as a nor'easter. And that's a different kind of storm, and it's completely not unprecedented. It was neither a superstorm nor was it unprecedented. It happens from time to time. Folks, on this radio station, we all know we live here in the Midwest. What happens in the Midwest? Normally, every spring, we get tornadoes and big thunderstorms. Well, we've had a few tornadoes blow through, and we've had some serious thunderstorms blow through. We had a derecho a few years ago that took down a tree in my yard. Took down a trees in a lot of people's yard. But that derecho was the result of the remnants of a hurricane, which blew inland, and it wasn't a particularly strong hurricane. So these things can combine up and create weather events that are being called extreme weather events, and we're being told that they're coming more and more and more often. Well, they're not. The fact is that that's part of the hype. And since a lot of the global warming and global climate change information is being pumped to young people to frighten them, to show them that, you know, this abnormal weather just is getting worse and worse. If you ask older people, I'm in my mid-50s, I've seen all this before. I can remember derechos blowing through when I was a kid here in Central Ohio. I grew up in Hebron. I can remember my dad had a radio tower on top of the garage. He was a CB operator and a ham radio operator. And our tower blew down in a 75-mile-an-hour wind one night that, when I was a little kid, scared me to death. The fact is that these events are, in fact, not particularly new. They're not particularly coming at any greater rapidity or with any greater force than they ever have. In fact, right now, we're in the middle of a very quiet period. That doesn't mean it'll stay quiet, not to lull you into complacency. We'll get some bad weather. Very well could come this winter. Who knows? And this could very well be a mild winter. Now, if it's a really bad winter, we'll hear that it's due to climate change. If it's a really mild winter, we'll hear it's due to climate change. If we have a normal winter, it will be, well, it's in spite of climate change. And if we have a more snow than normal, of course, that'll be also due to climate change. The fact is, we need to familiarize ourselves with the facts around this issue. And the fact is that many people are predicting, and by the way, the predictions that these people are making are much better than the quote-unquote climate change experts' predictions, because the models are really bad on that side. The models are pretty good on the non-man-made climate change side. And the fact is that the predictions that are being made by people who are looking at sunspot cycles and solar output and those kinds of things are much closer to what we're actually seeing. That being said, we need to get to Dr. Kaufman's presentation. I need to quit blathering, and he will explain it in a much better way than I can. He will show you what these things have to do, the controversies, the facts, how to marshal the facts, and then he'll tell you the important part, which is how global warming or climate change is being used to steal from you your liberty and your taxes and your property. In other words, how you're being plundered by it. So before we get too far out of hand in my bloviating, let's get to Dr. Kaufman with Plundered Part 4.
Last time we had global cooling in the 1600s and 1700s, and even into the 1800s to some extent, there was massive starvation in Europe. Massive starvation. Because we did no longer have the enough growing season to grow the crops to feed the people. Now, we have technology on our side this time. And I don't think it's going to be as severe, but it's still going to be a major problem. All the wheat fields and so forth in Canada probably aren't going to grow the wheat in time to harvest. That's going to hit their economy like a brick. So this is serious stuff. This article goes on to say that the predicted solar sleep is being compared to the last grand minimum on record, which occurred between 1645 and 1715, actually extended into the 1850. Known as the Maunder minimum, the roughly 70-year period coincided with the coldest spell in the Little Ice Age, when European canals regularly froze solid and alpine glaciers encroached upon mountain villages. The Thames River in England froze over every year. They had big celebrations, carnivals and so forth on the river. It hasn't frozen over for 80 or 90 years or more. This is a comparison of the sunspots over the last 400 years. You see the Maunder minimum, and then it extended into the 1800s with the Dalton minimum, and the number of solar flares and sunspots and so forth that we see on the sun. There is a high correlation between the number of sunspots, which indicate solar activity, and the Earth's temperature because of the effect on clouds. Now, this is the prediction. What's happened so far with solar cycle number 25. Now, you probably remember your science, in which there's 11-year solar cycle. Actually, it's 22 years, but 11 years. And if it's longer than 11 years, that usually means it's going to be cooler. And what we're seeing now, the last solar cycle, 24, ended 3 years late, before solar cycle number 25 started. And what we're seeing here is a much reduced cycle, almost 25% less solar flares, coronal mass ejections, and so forth this cycle than what we saw in cycle 24, which was less than cycle 23. And the prediction for solar scientists right now are saying solar cycle 26 will probably hardly be noticeable. There will be almost no solar flares. Now, I don't know if they're going to be right or not, but we're seeing a downward trend. And from a historical context, that is not good. Now, the other thing about this is very interesting, that the draft executive summary of the IPCC's upcoming was 2012 assessment. They postponed it to 2013. Actually, it was supposed to be 2011, but they postponed it to 12, and now they're postponing it to 13. I don't know why they're postponing this, but I suspect it's because all the data is mounting, showing that man-caused global warming isn't doing a thing. And this is what they say in the upcoming summary, the executive summary. Projected changes in climate extremes under different emission scenarios generally do not strongly diverge in the coming 2 to 3 decades, but these man-made signals are relatively small compared to natural climate variability over this same time frame. In other words, the natural climate variability is just going to totally suppress any man-caused imprint. Even the sign of projected changes in some climate extremes over this time frame is uncertain. What they're basically admitting is there's not going to be much evidence for man-caused global warming over the next 2 to 3 decades or more. And we're not even sure that it's going to be warming. Well, every evidence suggests it's definitely going to be cooling. And it could be as much as a degree and a half, which is very, very serious. We don't know. I hope it doesn't happen that badly. I hope it's just a cool period like we saw from 1945 to 1975. But nonetheless, it could actually happen. Green energy. You've heard a lot about wind farms and so forth. And I want to just show you this another video. This is not on the DVD that I gave you. This is part in our fight against the legislation that was pending in Congress a couple of years ago.
Hi, I'm Christy Pelletier. I find the current cap-and-trade legislation that will demand that 15 to 20% of our energy production come from renewable sources by the year 2020 highly disturbing. I think you would find it disturbing, too, if you knew the facts. Let me explain. Most people agree that renewable energy is something that should continue to be investigated and even put into commercial practice where it makes sense to do so. But to commit to making as much as 20% of our electric power production come from renewable energy sources, mostly wind and solar, by the year 2020 is just insane. It cannot be done economically with today's technology. Renewable energy currently makes up about 7% of our total energy consumption. 90% of that comes from hydro and biomass. Wind and solar make up less than 1%. So how do we double renewable energy by using wind and solar in just 10 years? The only way that this can be accomplished is by using huge government subsidies. Analysis after analysis show that this will double our electricity costs. Even President Obama admits energy costs will skyrocket. That money comes right out of our pockets. What really burns me up is that no one ever tells us that wind and solar power have serious limitations. The wind only blows 25% of the time, and the sun doesn't shine at night or when it's cloudy. The only backup is natural gas and coal, so that means we have to keep the coal-fired generating plants going as a backup. Of course, they're still spewing out CO2, so reductions in CO2 emissions are minimized. Not only that, but we would be paying for renewable and coal-generated electricity at the same time. President Obama tells us that green energy will create between 2 and 5 million new green jobs. But Spain has been doing this for over a decade, and they found that for every green job created, 2.2 jobs were lost in the regular economy. Worse, each new green job cost over a staggering $750,000. If this ratio holds for the United States, and there's no reason to suspect it won't, the net result may be a loss of 6 to 10 million jobs at a cost of $10 trillion by 2030. That is a huge hit on our already weak economy. The entire purpose of this cap-and-trade legislation is to force us, that's right, force us to reduce the amount of carbon-based energy we all use by progressively capping its production. In other words, it's forced rationing. We're supposed to reduce carbon emissions by 42% by the year 2030 and by 83% by 2050. There are presently no economically viable alternatives to fossil fuel, nor is there anything on the horizon. Are you ready to reduce your energy consumption by 20 to 60% while paying twice the costs for what you do use? This is insanity at its worst. Science now shows that man is not responsible for the warming of the 20th century. So why are we even considering this cap-and-trade legislation? This legislation must not pass. If you've never contacted your senators before, do it now.
Okay. What we're seeing here is that there is no economically viable substitution for fossil fuel energy. And I'm not even, fossil fuel is even a misnomer at this point, because it's becoming quite obvious that the hydrocarbons are created by other geologic forces, not the decay of vegetation and so forth back hundreds of thousands of years ago. I need to move along.
I was going to say, they call it abiotic.
Right. I don't want to get into that.
Well, wait a minute. You're fits into the evolutionary theory, though. That's important.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Okay. So what we have here is a situation where if we have this green energy, we still have to have the coal-fired or now gas-fired electrical generation going on at the same time concurrently, because the wind could suddenly die down or the sun could go behind a cloud. And we have to have a constant and reliable source of energy for us to be able to maintain our standard of living. If we did not have that fossil fuel energy in the background, basically what we would see is disruption, brownouts, and so forth all the time, because they cannot gear up more windmills or solar panels fast enough to make up the difference. Just can't be done. So we have two systems going. We have the system that we've always had before in operation, and we have now the very, very, very expensive green energy. And so we still have the same amount of carbon dioxide, assuming that it's causing global warming, which we know it isn't, but the same amount of emissions going on, and fooled into thinking that we're solving the problem with this green energy. It is so diabolical that it just nauseates me to realize that our government officials Obama especially, when he sees Europe collapsing because of the huge subsidies many of these European nations have given green energy development, and the crisis in their jobs because it's taking the jobs out of the private sector, and he's still pushing the same green energy. There's only two conclusions that you can make from that. Either he's such an ideologue, which I think he really is, that he will refuse reality, to accept reality, even if it's facing him dead in his face, or he is deliberately trying to bring down the United States economy. Because the whole global warming issue is now very obviously an attempt by the global elite to control carbon emissions. When you control carbon emissions, you control the economy. And when you control the economy, you control people. Simple as that. Now, a new thing is coming out of the EPA. Basically, ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, a fairly neutral organization, although they're being highly demonized right now because of this report. It just came out about 4 or 5 weeks ago, where they're saying that the economy is literally going to be derailed by the new EPA's boiler mat regulations. That's a new set of regulations, thousands and thousands of pages of new regulations that the EPA is coming out with to basically shut down our coal industry. It's going to reduce the number of coal-fired generators and so forth because they can never, never, ever meet these regulations. The utility mat rule could require retrofits for up to 753 electricity generating units, and up to 15 gigawatts of electricity could be forced into early retirement. That means very expensive units to replace them. No new coal generation plants can be built. I mean, it's so restricted that a new plant, no matter how efficient it is, it'll ever meet the requirements. The boiler mat rule risks nearly 800,000 jobs nationwide, and the EPA has not estimated a single health benefit for reducing the pollutants that this rule was intended to address. Not a single one. Now, the EPA basically says, well, it will over a 10-year period, it might reduce the health or asthma attacks by 6 people. It might save one life. But other studies have shown that it will not do anything. And you remember yesterday when I showed you the clip of Reed, Harry Reid, basically saying that there is not a single piece of regulatory authority that has caused an impact on our economy? Well, here you have it, folks. This is devastating. These progressives cannot connect to reality. They live off in the world by themselves, and they are bringing this country down. They have to be voted out of office. Going on with this, the cross-state air pollution rule, which is a part of this, could threaten up to another 7 gigawatts of electricity generation, with early retirement affecting reliability and affordability of electricity. The EPA estimates that the rule could cost $2.4 million. Other analysts think it's closer to $20 billion, even as emissions have already declined. In other words, the things that we have in place are causing a reduction in emissions. Cooling water intake regulation could affect more than 1,000 coal, oil, steam, and gas steam generating units, totaling 250 gigawatts. As well as roughly one-third of all installed nuclear capacity, approximately 60 gigawatts. This could threaten up to 41 gigawatts with early retirement and would also affect electric reliability across the country. This is devastating. The EPA has become the high priest of this country and is deliberately seeking to destroy it. You can't look at it any other way. In order to protect nature. All of the discussion we had yesterday about the religious nature of the environmental movement and so forth and what the United Nations is attempting to do is based in religious doctrine. And this is the classic example of it. And the EPA is out of control because the EPA is part of the IUCN, as we described earlier. They're involved in implementing this eco-spiritual agenda. Here you see it. The EPA has begun a war against coal mining by halting already approved permits, holding back and unnecessarily delaying permits as much as 5 years. The court system has held the Obama administration in contempt of court because they were not issuing the permits. And he had the gall earlier this year to say that there is more oil being produced right now than he's ever done. He's lying because those permits were issued during the Bush administration. It's unbelievable what this man will say. The top 10 states impacted by the EPA regulatory train wreck are Illinois, West Virginia, Ohio, Alabama, Michigan, Indiana. You're right in the heart of it right here. Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Kentucky, and North Carolina. You can expect your energy costs to go up as much as 50%. England, who has done a lot to install wind generating, has seen their electrical generating costs go up by 75%. Over half of the English families are now in what they call energy poverty because they're having to spend so much money on electricity. The United States is under attack from within. We have a fifth column, and it's called the EPA. In the past couple of years, the Environmental Protection Agency has begun a war on American standard of living, promulgating and finalizing the most onerous regulatory assault on the American economy since its inception more than 40 years ago. You know, the EPA was not founded on a congressional law or act. It was created out of thin air by the president. And here it basically has our nation by the throat. If we don't follow the Constitution the way it was structured, we always are going to get into trouble. Yeah, I know. This is the tip of the iceberg. And in fact, the ALEC report goes into much deeper. I just can't spend the time necessary. And so let's take a look now at education. I think it's important at least to touch on this. I spent two chapters in the book that you were given yesterday on education. I can't even begin to cover it in this conversation now. I've had to reduce the size of what I want to cover. In the 1950s, the Congressional Research Committee was probably the last congressional committee to ever advertise what was going on by this global elite. Found that education foundations contributed to the reckless public spending and overgrowth of government by radical educators who suborned the schools. So this congressional committee found exactly what was happening. The foundations were spending hundreds of millions of dollars to implement the socialist agenda, the progressive agenda, into our school systems to brainwash our kids. Now, if you happen to be going to a public school, understand that this doesn't have to ruin your education. But talk with your parents. Get your parents involved in what's going on in school so that they can kind of help you understand what is happening. Because if you're in the public school system, I would basically say, and I think I said this yesterday, that anybody that has graduated from high school that is less than 50 years old, maybe 45, is probably indoctrinated, fully indoctrinated, and they don't know it. They can be very intelligent people. But you cannot make good decisions if you're not given the right information. You can be as intelligent as you want to, but if you don't know the facts, you're going to make wrong decisions every time. That's why I say that most liberals really want to do the right thing, and you can approach them if you don't build a wall between yourself and them. If you say that, you know, it's been my finding that such and such and such and such, rather than saying, you're nuts. Draw them into the conversation. And don't put them on the spot. You won't win the argument right there because it's really not an argument, but you'll put something in their minds that they're going to be working on over the next several days or weeks. Because they have been indoctrinated. And they don't know it. The state of California back in those days found that the curricula played up Marxism and destroyed our traditions. In other words, we knew what was happening. And yet, the progressives by that time were so strong that they were able to continue, and now you never hear a word because they control the media. And they control Congress. They control our court systems. And they control the media. Yeah, I already said the media. Frederick Skinner. I'm not going to go into who they were or what they did. Alfred Kinsey, I think you probably know him as a sex studies and so forth. They used the Pavlovian training for sex and personality deconstruction. In other words, to tear down your natural resistance to this kind of garbage so that you can be psychologically imprinted with what they want to know. Benjamin Bloom wrote the taxonomy of education objectives, which defined and classified learning behavior that broke behavior into measurable categories that deny the personality and spiritual side of a person. Tear it down. It led to mastery learning and eventually outcome-based education. In fact, Benjamin Bloom is credited as being the father of outcome-based education. In other words, train the student to fit a certain widget, a certain niche in industry or something, to do a certain thing, but don't give him any of the tools to be a free thinker. Engel versus Vitale in 1962 forbade school-sponsored prayer and Bible readings. You know, it's very interesting that you can trace back all the problems that we've had over the last 40 years now, or 50 years, back to this decision. When you no longer had a moral anchor in our school systems. Now, I'm not saying the decision itself caused this, but it basically created the conditions, the vacuum necessary for moral decay. And right now, we're in a free fall, moral free fall in this country. The Behavioral Science Teacher Education Program, or BSTEP, in 1970. Now, most people have never heard of this. I'll explain just a little bit of it. I explain a lot more in the book. It's a plan developed by all segments of society to deliberately dumb down students to be compliant global citizens, which are led by the elite. You will not believe when I'm going to give you a couple of paragraphs out of this that just are shocking. By the way, that BSTEP program was supported not only by, and it was funded by the HEW, the Health, Education, Welfare Department of the United States, but it was also supported by most of our mainline universities in this country, the RAND Foundation, a whole host of primary corporations, and so forth. It was dozens of these different entities that were involved in creating this. It's huge, and they are implementing it. The National Education Association became the most powerful institution in America as a single entity, still is. UNESCO's World Core Curricula spawned Clinton's Goals 2000, which basically are based on the World Core Curricula, which is a very occult curricula. They use the whole language method of reading. How many are, no, you're all homeschooled for most of the part. But in our public education system, I was a victim of this. I was one of the very first victims of whole language methodology, where you have to recognize a word to know it. You cannot use phonetics because they don't teach you phonetics to sound out a word. And so you have to totally learn that word before you can understand what it means in a sentence. It's very difficult for students to do this. Very difficult. And as a consequence, they become poor readers. So they don't read, which is exactly the goal. creating a cognitive dissonance or confusion in the students. It led to Careers Act in 1995 with bipartisan support. You remember the Progressive Party or the progressive ideology is in both Republican and Democratic parties. It's not a party issue. No Child Left Behind and Obama's Race to the Top. They're core components of all this. They're all designed to basically dumb down our students in high school and our lower elementary schools. Now, the Behavioral Ed Science Teacher Education, or BSTEP, said in this in the preliminary statements, the program is designed to focus the skills and the knowledge of behavioral scientists. Calculations of the future and how to modify it are no longer considered obscure academic pursuits. We are getting closer to developing effective methods for shaping the future and are advancing in fundamental social and individual evolution. In other words, at this time, when this was published in 1970, they were almost there where they can control how the student is going to think. So that when they graduate, they are inculcated with the socialist mentality, and that is normal to them, and they do not understand what we're talking about when we talk about constitutional principles. It's totally foreign to them. They get no constitutional studies in their social sciences and so forth. And so they're deliberately dumbed down to what it really takes to develop a free and prosperous nation. They don't understand it at all. And this is what they're trying to program. Most people will tend to be hedonistic, that's pleasure-seeking, and a dominant elite will provide bread and circuses to keep the social dissension and disruption at a minimum, football games and so forth. Now, there's nothing wrong with football games or any of these other things, but when they begin to dominate your life as the goal for what you want to do, then you're no longer paying attention to what they're doing. A small elite will carry society's burdens. In other words, you don't have to worry yourself anymore. They'll do it all for us. The resulting impersonal manipulation of most people's lifestyles will be softened by provisions for pleasure-seeking and guaranteed physical necessities. Our welfare program. The controlling elite will engage in power plays largely without the involvement of most people. There's all sorts of things going on behind the scenes that we're never told. This society will be a leisurely one. People will study, play, and travel. Some will be in the various stages of the drug-induced experiences. Is that true today? You better believe it. Each individual will be saturated with ideas and information. We're in the age of information. We're overloaded with information. But that doesn't give you wisdom. Some will be self-selected. Other kinds will be imposed overtly by those who assume responsibility for our actions. Relatively few individuals will be able to maintain control over their opinions. Most will be pawns of competing opinion molders. And boy, are we seeing this today. Now, if you're as old as I am, I was actually born before dirt was invented. You know what it was like back in the 1950s and 60s before all this garbage really was infiltrated into our educational processes. And folks, the world that we're living in today was nothing. It's nothing like what I had as a child. The differences are unbelievable. I never thought I'd ever see this when I realized it could happen. Now let's just take a look at one of the main drivers of our public education program. Dr. Shirley McEwen, she's been involved with the Department of Education, with the National Education Association, with a whole lot of things. At this time, she was involved as a director at the education laboratories that designed programs to actually dumb us down and using psychological methods. Now, she'll use language that sounds okay, but if you understand what they're trying to get at by associating this with what I just read to you out of BSTEP, you will see it everywhere. And this is only a very small part of her talk.
It seems to me that far too much of our efforts have been focused on the issue of let's find a short-term fix and fix up these schools and taking care of them, rather than the issue of understanding that what we're into is a total restructuring of the society. What is happening in America today and what is happening in Kansas and the Great Plains is not simply a chance situation and the usual winds of change. What it amounts to is a total transformation of our society. We have moved into a new era. That era we talk about as the information society, and we've already gone through a couple phases of it. But what I'm not sure that we have really begun to comprehend or to act on sufficiently is the incredible amount of organizational restructuring and human resource development restructuring. The whole ballgame in this particular change society is that there's only two things that really matter. One of those is the information capital that we can put together and our ability to use information to produce products and to produce new ideas and new information. And secondly, to produce human capital. It'd be easy to say, well, if it isn't broke, why fix it? Why should we try to deal with that? And unfortunately, what I would say to you is that while the system still continues to work for some parts of the population, it isn't going to work over the long run. And what has to happen at conferences like this and throughout other dialogues that go on in the state is a commitment of understanding that what we have to be about is building a future. It is the future that motivates us. It's not what we're doing now.
It's their future.
You have to understand the breadth of the task that's before us. You cannot begin to think about restructuring of education without understanding that our total society is in a crisis of restructuring. And you can't get away from it. You can't go into rural areas, you can't go into churches, you can't go into government, you can't go into business and hide from the fact that what we are facing is a total restructuring of the society. First of all, we have to understand this bend in curriculum is that we no longer are teaching facts to children. It is almost impossible for us to guess the kinds of facts that they will need. That basically, we are still measuring the output of schools by national tests, which measure nothing but factual recall. And the issue for most children and the issues for the society is that what has changed in education today is that we no longer see the teaching of facts and information as the primary outcome of education. We also must provide more individualized and learner-directed learning. We have to understand that the only way that anyone ever learns is from their own frame of reference and that all learning begins with the affective parts of life. What we know is that the earlier we intervene into the lives of people, the cheaper it is. What I would hope this state would do would be to undertake a series of demonstration projects to build learning communities in some rural areas where we're serving all ages, where we begin to demonstrate what can happen when we put people together and when we deal with them in a holistic fashion, and to begin to demonstrate schools of the future. And
what she's basically saying is that they are creating a total transformation of society. One of the other things that the Beat Step program said that was not in the quotes that I gave you is that this is going to cause a tearing of our society fabric, almost totally rip us apart, and that's happening right now. We are totally divided at this particular point in time. And what she's saying is that they actually started this in the urban and suburban areas where they had the highest concentration of people and the most graduates and so forth. But now in 1989, they wanted to move into rural America. No longer teaching facts as a normal education would do, but to start programming the students to think a certain way. That's their future. Don't take my word for it. Look it up yourself. This agenda is diametrically or diabolically evil. And yet they believe it's the way to go because they have all knowledge. Remember, there isn't a single progressive that doesn't understand that they are much smarter than you and I, much more intelligent. They know what's best for us. Okay, biodiversity. We have just enough time to get through this, and I won't get to the last segment on Christianity. By the way, our nation was founded on Christian principles, and there's plenty of evidence. They will say that it's not, but there is all kinds of evidence. Even Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and so forth, that are often called deists, understood how important the Christian religion was as the glue to hold the Constitution together and make it work. And it's all in my book. The last chapter, spent half the chapter discussing this. But it is what we need to get back to. If we don't get back to our Christian roots, we are dead meat. Okay, Agenda 21 came out in 1992. Bush signed it. President Clinton created the President's Council on Sustainable Development, or the PCSD, in 1993. And in 1996, this document was published out of this council. Now, the council itself consisted of 25 people from various agencies and so forth in industry, in the private sector. 12 of those people are also members of the IUCN. You see how they basically have done it? The IUCN has directed so much of what we're seeing right now in our backyards, and it also contributed enough people to this process that it made sure that their goals were included in Sustainable America. Now, Sustainable America was broken down into 7 different sub-documents. I'm not going to go into specifics on any of them, but it affects all major areas of our society, just like Agenda 21 itself would. Sustainable America meets all the conditions of Agenda 21. And instantaneously, in 1996, if you're old enough to understand this, and especially if you lived in rural America, all of a sudden, all the federal agencies seemed to change. And even in the Department of Transportation and so forth, they switched basically gas tax money and so forth from repaving and upgrading and building new roads to high-speed rail or transportation that had nothing to do with cars, because they were now, as their set of goals for every federal agency was now based on Sustainable America. Every contract that was let out to a company, every grant that was given to a state or a local government and so forth was rooted back in Sustainable America, which met the conditions for Agenda 21. So a lot of Tea Party people, when they go into a city council or county commission meeting and so forth, basically say you're implementing Agenda 21, and of course the council has no clue what Agenda 21 is. They say, no, we're not. And they're technically correct, but they are implementing Sustainable America, because the contract, the grant that they got from the federal government, it links directly back to Sustainable America, which then goes back to Agenda 21. It's important to make that distinction, because they will ignore you if you say Agenda 21. You have to go through the Sustainable America. And when they give you 2 minutes to give your input, there isn't enough time to do that. Now, you're not going before city councils or county commissioners and so forth, but when you graduate, you may. The only way that you can get this message across is to 9, 10, 12 people give successive components, witnesses, testimony to what needs to be said. So the whole message is given by different people having 2 or 3 minute segments where they can actually do public input. It's the only way you can do it, but it is effective. Most of your city councils and so forth are liberal. They're not necessarily progressives. Some of them are, and you'll never convince them. They will die with their dying breath that what they say is the absolute truth, because they know better than you do. But a liberal is a liberal primarily because of how they have been brainwashed. They want to do the right thing, and they're open to what that right thing might be if you approach it from the right direction. Okay. Now, in 1993, the IUCN, basically, with the EPA and other federal agencies, every one of those federal agencies said something to this effect. This is an internal working document. This is a year after the Earth Summit. And this is what they're planning. Natural resources and environmental agencies should develop a joint strategy to help the United States fulfill its existing international obligations. In other words, the Convention on Biological Diversity and Agenda 21. Well, Bush did sign Agenda 21, which obligated the United States to its premises. But the Biological Diversity Treaty had not even been sent to the U.S. Senate for ratification. That would not happen until 1994. And yet you had federal agencies implementing the conditions of the treaty in 1993. The executive branch should direct federal agencies to evaluate national policies in light of international policies and obligations and to amend national policies to achieve international objectives. This is the EPA. This is the EPA basically making up its own rules and laws to affect, to reflect back on the international agenda without going through Congress. And that's exactly what they're doing today. There's no congressional authority for them to do what they're doing today. They have to stretch the Clean Air Act to its maximum to implement this Boiler Mac regulations that they're doing right now that is going to destroy us. The Convention on Biological Diversity was written by the IUCN in 1981. It was revealed to the world in 1992. Merely an 18-page outline of a treaty that the U.S. Senate was asked to ratify. It was motherhood and apple pie. The Convention on Biological Diversity was explained in an 1,100-page document called the Global Biodiversity Assessment that, the IUCN wrote, along with the World Resources Institute. It's one of the most anti-human documents ever published by a governmental study. It calls for the eradication of two-thirds of the world's population. I'm only going to give you a couple things here. The Western worldview is characteristic of large-scale societies heavily independent or dependent on resources brought in from considerable distances. It is a worldview that is characterized by the denial of the sacred attributes of nature, which became firmly established about 2,000 years ago with the Judeo-Christian Islamic religious traditions. It's taking direct aim at especially Christianity. It goes out of its way to attack Christianity, just like Rousseau did, that I explained yesterday. Property rights for one option for insuring against excessive species depletion is the allocation of property rights. In other words, you don't have any God-given property rights. You only have property rights at the pleasure of the government, just like Rousseau established. The reallocation of property rights implies the redistribution of assets. So now you have to give your rights away to someone else, usually the community. Property rights can still be allocated to the environmental public good, but in this case, they should be restricted to usufructual, what's that? Well, let me back up. Basically, we knew that this document existed. We tried to get it in the Senate's hands. We could not get it out of the United Nations. It was still in draft form. We had the actual contract. The United Nations let the IUCN and the World Resources Institute, so we knew it was there, but we couldn't get it. And this is how God works. I'm leaving out a whole pile of things and other alternative things, and it's just miraculous in their nature. But we knew it existed. We stopped the ratification basically in August of that same year, 1994. Miraculous. We shut down the Senate phone system with so many people calling in. Basically, in September, it came up again for ratification on September either 29th or 30th. 2 days before that, we had tried to get this out of New York. Couldn't do it. The person that we contacted there knew someone in London that might be able to get it. That person couldn't get it, but they knew somebody in Bonn, Switzerland, which is the headquarters of the German Republic at that time. They couldn't get it. And they knew someone in Glan, Switzerland. What happens to be in Gland, Switzerland? The headquarters of the IUCN. By that time, they didn't know who we were. They didn't know that we were trying to stop the treaty. They thought we were trying to promote the treaty. So they FedExed, the IUCN FedExed Chapter 10, which is now Chapter 13 in the final document, to us. It was 400 pages, and we read through this. Each of us taking 100 pages. There were four of us. I had this section. I have a PhD. When I got to that word, usufructual, I had no idea what that meant. I thought it was a swear word. Well, it is, really. And I looked it up in my own college dictionary, and I won't tell you how old that is. You won't find it in the modern dictionaries. But the concept of the usufruct system was started in the Roman Empire, and it means that Caesar owns everything. And he allocates out to his friends and so forth who gets to be the farming, who gets to manufacture, and so all the way down the line. It's a permitting process. This was the smoking gun. Representative areas in all major ecosystems in a region need to be reserved. Reserve blocks should be as large as possible. Buffer zones should be established around these core areas, and the corridors should connect these areas. This is basic design essential to the Wildlands Project in the United States. I had already told in August, I was down in the U.S. Senate in August, trying to convince them this was a very dangerous treaty, using a map that I'll show you in just a second, that it was the Wildlands Project. Why? Because the Wildlands Project was created by the same people in the IUCN that wrote the treaty. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize there's a connection. And this is what the Wildlands Project does over the next 100, well, actually, it's 90 years now. All the red areas there are no human activity whatsoever. Total withdrawal. They're all wilderness areas. The yellow buffer zones severely limit human activity to very gentle agriculture and other activities, cattle production and so forth. Only the green areas can you have normal activity. Well, there isn't much green area. This is going to happen all across the world. And basically, what you see right here is that they have to reduce the Earth's human population by two-thirds or more in order to accomplish this, because there isn't enough room for agriculture there to feed the people. I could go on, but you get the point. And I think that's where, yeah, that's where I need to end. Understand. By the way, I have some of those maps out there. If you want to pick one up, you can. This is a very, very dangerous agenda. Extremely dangerous, being led by people who cannot connect with reality. Literally, psychologically, proven in psychiatric tests, cannot connect to reality. And they're in charge. They're in charge of Congress, the presidency, the White House, our federal courts, our education process, and so forth. We have, or you have, a major job ahead of you if we survive as a nation. Thank you.
Well, that was the last of Dr. Kaufman's presentation for this particular series on his book, Plundered. As always, his PowerPoint presentation and the embedded videos are something you really need to see for yourself. If you really want to be able to do that, you can go to www.campamerican.com. Go to the 2012 videos and you can buy a copy of this. Actually, you'll be making a donation to Camp American, for which you will receive as a gift the presentation, Plundered. Again, that's campamerican.com, 2012 videos, and Plundered. That's it for this week. You can get a hold of us if you'd like to here at the Institute for Principled Policy through our website, www.principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. And we will also have the book, Plundered, available. And we will also make a link to the video that you can get a copy of. So again, that's www.principledpolicy.com, and you can contact us through the contact information there. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.